This is your Uncle Don here with the 326th opening of the Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. I have been and will continue to be merciless in excoriating my province's Liberal government for duplicity and betrayal of campaign promises. I believe they've misled the electorate and are not serving in the interests of most British Columbians, but look at what our neighbors in the U.S. are suffering through. A recent article in the New Yorker magazine contains the following paragraph. From coast to coast, from tundra to coral reef, state governments are in an awful fix. Their budget gaps are on track to add up to at least a third of $1 trillion. In half the states, education funding is being cut, which means bigger classes, shoddier facilities, and fewer frills like music, art, languages, and library books. States are closing parks, draining rainy day funds, and shrinking services for children, the elderly, and the disabled. Close quote. I don't know what kinds of promises were made to citizens down there during state election campaigns, but I'm sure a lot of Americans are as angry with their state leaders as I am with Gordon Campbell. This is not to excuse Gordon's betrayals, which cannot be blamed on the economy, like the freeze of the minimum wage, making British Columbia's the lowest in Canada, even as his own wage has more than doubled. I will not forget his sale of BC Rail, sabotage of BC Hydro, and infliction of the FST, among his many other sins. The list of his actions, and lack thereof, against the interests of our citizens is long, and his legacy will not be flattering. I have little sympathy for our dear leader in Ottawa, either, but he takes heat for all the wrong reasons. For instance, while Campbell is on the griddle over dumping the FST on British Columbians, I've heard nothing about Harper's coming up with $1.6 billion bribe to persuade Campbell to take the jump. Where did that money come from? It'll just be added to the federal debt, left to future taxpayers across the nation to pay. But Harper is held to account for his diet. First, he was accused of pocketing a souvenir cookie in a church, an affront to God, according to some. Then he caught hell for eating raw seal, or not eating it, in an Inuit banquet. If he ate it, he angers the animal rights lobbies. If he did not, and his photo was just another setup for the press, he's insulted our Arctic Inuit. Just another reason for our Prime Minister to keep his mouth shut. After a half century of slavishly supporting American foreign policy under the rule of their conservative Liberal Democratic Party, Japanese had enough. The Democratic Party of Japan, winning a majority in the Diet, is more liberal than the Liberal Democratic Party it replaces. We in British Columbia should know that liberal in a party name is meaningless today. The new Japanese Prime Minister has promises to reorient his foreign policy away from dependent on the United States. Smart move. Any chance of Canada's following suit? Just joking. A Japanese constitution, written while the country was under American occupation, forbids the country from maintaining a military machine. It has no army, navy, or air force. Japan does, however, have a few individuals and a bit of hardware put aside as a self-defense force. In 2002, the latest year for which I found figures, Japan maintained 240,000 folks in this wee self-defense force, costing them $37 billion. For self-defense, mind you, Japan possesses submarines, destroyers, frigates, combat aircraft, and armed helicopters. It defends sea lanes within 1,000 nautical miles of its shores. It did not engage in either the Korean War nor the Vietnam War, but it profited handsomely as a base for American soldiers and as a supplier of war material for American forces. In 2002, there was a residue of 38,000 U.S. occupation forces in Japan, for which the host nation paid 40% of the cost. Under its new government, we may expect to see an agreement with the Americans, which will have the last of the occupiers bugger off. They may also alter foreign-inflicted constitution to admit that they do indeed have a military. Japan is finally, 64 years after defeat in World War II, finding its wings as an independent nation. I wish them luck. If Americans and their NATO stooges should manage to tame Afghanistan, might they expect to have a government which will also find independence in 64 years? Even if they should, I expect that Afghanistan, like Japan, will still have American occupiers and bases after a couple of generations. Our Canadian government was unknowingly complicit in developing American torture procedures. We published a pamphlet for boaters entitled Survival in Cold Waters, containing estimates of how long one dumped in frigid water of various temperatures could live without suffering hypothermia or death. This publication was handy for American torturers in designing protocols for immersion of prisoners without causing permanent physical harm. Anyone who has had to perform any task using cold water knows how fast such exposure becomes painful. When applied to the entire body, it can be excruciating. Psychological damage to victims is beyond the purview of torturer's mandate. I won't touch on the mental damage done to those applying torture as their sadistic impunity spills over to their families and communities. Reports have detailed official methods used to make the lives of prisoners miserable at best and agonizing at worst are reminiscent of the so-called research performed by notorious Dr. Mengele in Nazi concentration camps. I have no doubt that Bush's torturers researched his findings also. If President Obama were to live up to expectations of his supporters, he would open prosecution procedures against Richard Cheney and everyone down the line, from planners to actual CIA operatives and others who mistreated helpless captives. Protocols for infliction of pain were written by doctors, medical doctors, the kind who once subscribed to the Hippocratic Oath and pledged, first, do no harm. These men and women should be stripped of their licenses at the very least, and perhaps tried for complicity in crimes against humanity. Don't hold your breath awaiting serious action against savages of the Bush regime. Orthodox Jews won't touch pork, and the swine flu won't touch them if a group of rabbis and Kabbalah mystics is successful. They circled Israel in a chartered plane, blowing ram's horns and praying to God to spare their citizens from this plague. They expect success, as previous flights have worked. The first prevented a Nazi invasion of Palestine. Later flights avoided involvement in the 1991 Gulf War and stemmed terrorist attacks in 1996. Certainly God's ear is attuned to the sound of the ram's horn, even over the noise of aircraft engines. I suggest the Canadians use this proven method, ram's horns and all, to prevent Gordon Campbell and Stephen Harper. Ed Broadbent has finally spoken the forbidden word, taxation. In an opinion piece for the Globe and Mail, he made the case for a position I long held, that inequality of income, wealth, and opportunity are the most important elements fostering social instability. He said that inequality is growing faster in Canada than in the majority of developed countries. As a remedy, Ed would tax the rich. He said, quote, "They've made all the gains from broadly defined globalization in recent years, and we have shortages of money for public housing, for post-secondary education, for everything. Why shouldn't they pay more? I say they should, and this not only helps the middle-class people and the poor, it helps everyone. In health outcomes, levels of participation, reductions in crime, you name it," close quote. He declared that the NDP is not a democratic party. "We're a social democratic party, the core value of which is equality." Now, if he can just convince Jack Layton. Good news, the American economy appears to be recovering. The bad news is that emphasis should be on appears. An increase in consumer spending created a temporary upward blip because hundreds of thousands of people took advantage of the Cash for Clunkers program, granting as much as $4,500 to people trading in an old vehicle for new. The increase was temporary and illusory. According to an economist at the University of Chicago School of Business, quote, "If all you've done is move that, meaning car purchases, from tomorrow to today, then the economy is going to lag even more tomorrow." Automakers are prompting Canada to initiate an incentive like the U.S. one, but wiser heads know the stimulus would be short-lived, leaving us with a greater deficit to no permanent avail. British Columbia could do well by emulating Norway or Brazil rather than Alberta. Our neighboring province has blown the wealth derived from oil and gas by cutting taxes. Norway funnels the bulk of its oil revenue into a fund for the future. Brazil is considering a law that would likewise take oil revenue and place it with a government holding company. President Lula declared, "We don't have the right to take the money we're going to get with this oil and waste it." the BC government has brought in a great deal of one-time windfall money from oil and gas leases in our Northeast. We also saw a unique billion-dollar gain from selling off our valuable railway. This money was not used to alleviate homelessness. It did not go to schools to decrease class sizes. It did not remedy our distinction as having Canada's largest rate of child poverty. Nor did it go into a fund like Norway's or Brazil's. It was used to lower and lower again our tax rates, for the wealthy and corporations, of course. The money is now gone. With no savings, we face a record deficit that will be with us for years, and there's little hope that tax rates can be restored during a recession. Our lack of collective foresight, or even common sense, has put us in this situation, and the Campbell regime has a lot to answer for. There was a time when the name General Motors stood for corporate strength. In 1952, GM Chairman Charles Wilson, testifying before the Senate Armed Forces Committee, proudly declared, "What is good for the country is good for General Motors, and what's good for General Motors is good for the country." General Motors stock was the soundest of investments, and their bonds were rated on a par with U.S. Treasuries. This company was unchallenged as the most respected in the world's automotive industry. Its nearest competitor, Ford, stood in its shadow. How times change. A century after its founding, GM has shedded brands and plants. This company, which employed nearly 500,000 workers, is expected to have fewer than 41,000 after restructuring. They went through a humiliating bankruptcy and had to beg public funds to keep afloat. The latest acknowledgement of their reduced status in the public eye is a decision by management to delete the GM logo from the side of future vehicles. What they used to call their mark of excellence is now an embarrassment. In the future, their advertising will emphasize their brand names, Chevrolet, Cadillac, and whatever else survives, rather than the name of its humbled parent. There are many who wonder whether the fate of General Motors is a precursor of the direction of its home country. Since the decline of the British pound as a world reserve currency, the American dollar has stood unchallenged. The flood of dollars into Europe and around the world after World War II made it the universal exchange currency in most international transactions. When Saudi Arabia sold oil to South Africa, settlement was in U.S. dollars. Nations filled their exchequers with U.S. dollar-denominated instruments, largely U.S. Treasury bonds. The dollar was king. Times are changing. A few countries are beginning to trade their oil in euros or yen. Soon the Chinese yuan may become common in the currency trades as that country's trade expands in both imports and exports. America's maintenance of its vast empire and imperial armed forces engaged in two serious wars are draining finances, forcing it ever deeper into debt to foreigners. The stimulus program, sloshing billions of new dollars into circulation, is diluting their value. There may come a tipping point where the decline of the dollar prompts those holding vast reserves of U.S. debt to begin selling off their dollar instruments and putting their reserves elsewhere. The growing flood of American Treasury bonds into financial markets, or a failure of one of their new debt auctions, could trigger a rush to dump the trillions of dollars held by foreign governments. No one wants to be the last to hold on to a declining asset, as we've seen in the recent stock market collapse. The United States government would never default on its foreign debts. They're denominated in American dollars, so they need only run the printing presses to redeem their bonds. If China goes to Washington requesting redemption of its $1 trillion in bonds, Obama could answer the door with a newly printed $1 trillion bill, as was done recently by Zimbabwe's government. But what would that $1 trillion bill buy? China is gradually using its store of dollars to buy up resources, companies, and commodities around the world. They're cleverly unloading their dollars for real goods, goods to feed their economy, goods to feed their people. We're loath to recognize the sea change in world power happening around us. The implications for Canada, affixed as we are to the American economy like a barnacle on a whale, are frightening. Over the years, especially under the rule of Lion Brian Mulroney and his free trade deals, we've lost our industries and independence. When the whale dives, we dive with it. And if the whale dies, we die with it. It's too late to divorce ourselves from the U.S. and attach ourselves to the Chinese whale, probably. And the prospects seem hopelessly dim under our present federal regime. This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. Before I launch into my next diatribe, I make the following disclaimer. Long ago, between real jobs, I worked for a couple of weeks at the local Greyhound terminal. During that brief time, I witnessed shoddy maintenance of equipment and looting of goods by staff, including the boss, who pilfered fruit from transported crates. Found wallets were stripped. I was not pleased by what I saw. The Greyhound Bus Company, a monopoly in Canada, is blackmailing our government. They demand government subsidies to continue running unprofitable lines, most notably in Manitoba, where they threaten to cut service altogether. Will Harper's government, already carrying a huge deficit, add to it by giving in to Greyhound? Or might it have the guts and gumption to stand up to this corporation? If so, they could explain that Greyhound's protected monopoly is an indivisible whole, not one in which they can pick and choose routes, running the profitable ones and abandoning the unprofitable. This would be an opportunity to demand that they expand service to places not yet provided public transport. For instance, since our beloved provincial government decided to abandon its Prospector Rail service prior to giving away BC Rail, this train provided Lillooet a connection to Prince George, North Vancouver, and points between. This town joined other small communities in having no public transport whatsoever. It deserves and needs public transport service. If Greyhound refused to expand service, we might invite them to take their buses and bugger off. Surely there's another company that would be willing to provide rural Canada with vital transport, or perhaps, horror of horrors, the job could be turned over to a Crown corporation to be run as a public utility. What some saw as a depressing provincial budget, others found humorous. Take the mathematical gyrations used to explain how the FST's reduction of $1.9 billion in business taxes, coupled with all those tax breaks for consumers, would add up to a gain in the government's accounts, or the declaration by Colin Hanson that any unanticipated surpluses would be used to pay down BC's debt, and his government would enshrine that promise in law. That law, of course, would coexist with the current law prohibiting government from running a deficit at all. Right. We now know that the CIA contracted Blackwater to carry out assassinations of alleged al-Qaeda operatives on foreign soil. General Michael Hayden, director of the CIA between 2006 and 2009, declared that this program was insignificant. Had it not been, he would have informed Congress as required by law. Piffle, a tempest in a teapot. Besides, he said, killing al-Qaeda leaders would not have been assassinations as such, but that is killing in self-defense. Let me take that definition at face value. If true, and killing perceived enemies on foreign soil is self-defense, I'd be forced to look at the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon in a different light. Did these buildings not contain enemies of Islam representing, respectively, the foci of economic and military power of the United States? By the good general's own definition, those attacks were self-defense. Closer to home, let me assume that Omar Khadr did indeed kill an American soldier with a hand grenade. Was this not an enemy violently confronting him on foreign soil? It looks like a clear case of self-defense, especially since Omar was legally an infant at the time. One should be cautious when changing definitions to suit and legitimize one's actions. Here's another example of a rationalization that can boomerang. Israelis claim to have a right to infest land inhabited by Palestinians for generations. A Guardian quote from a colonist bent on a takeover of land occupied by others stated, quote, "The land of Israel was given by God to the people of Israel." Period. End of argument. This adamant position rests on certain old writings penned by men who thought the earth was flat. The purported gift overrules all claims by Palestinians. God said so, and thus the case rests. Whether Palestinians have contrary claims, the settlement of them rests on power, military power of which they have little but improvised rockets and small arms smuggled into their isolated pockets of land, surrounded as they are by enemies armed by the United States. They have no air force. They have no navy. Many Jews and Christians accept the rationalizations of Israel. God granted them the land of others. But then there's the case of the North America. The original inhabitants of our continent knew that the land was granted to them by their great creator. It was only after a confused and lost Italian in search of India landed in America that this claim was challenged. First Nations belief in the Great Creator rests on ground as firm as the Jewish and Christian claim of a sky god. Do our natives not have a sound argument for taking over Canadian and American real estate? Would they not have the right to reclaim Manhattan Island, returning the white man's beads and telling them they're being evicted? As with everything else, in the final analysis, all such arguments are settled by military power. I eagerly await the announcement that the Cree have developed nuclear weapons and how this will affect their land claims. Here's a question for you, history majors. Name the two nations which have developed or been on the verge of developing weapons of mass destruction and then voluntarily dismantled them. I'll give you the answer in a few minutes. The Yahoo Alberta Conservative Legislature has done it again. They enacted Bill 44, mandating that schools give advance notice to parents whenever instruction will touch on religion, human sexuality, or sexual orientation. This will allow parents of Johnny or Janie to pull their wee ones out of class before they can be infested with alien ideas. Gods forbid that their kids should learn of other superstitions or what goes on down there in their bodies. Let them soak up their parents' weird cultish beliefs and remain ignorant of sexuality or the diversity thereof until they get into trouble. After all, trouble is what makes for larger families to fill the churches. When will British Columbia's Liberals come up with a variant of this reactionary rule? Or have they already? The two nations voluntarily dismantling nuclear weapons programs are South Africa and Libya. Surprised? You may have seen the movie Moscow on the Hudson, containing the scene where a refugee from the Soviet Union visits an American supermarket asking where the coffee line is. When he is shown the aisle with 100 varieties and brands of coffee, he goes berserk. I didn't understand that feeling until I returned from a 1986 visit to revolutionary Nicaragua. This poor country, whose people had thrown out one of the nastiest of American-supported dictatorships, was fighting for its very life on two borders. The Contras, a ragtag bunch of mercenaries and remnants of Somoza's torturers, were running amok, burning newly established schools and clinics while avoiding confrontation with the Sandinista army. Reagan's proxy army was bleeding the country dry. Inflation was rampant while consumer goods were scarce. My wife and I visited a supermarket in Managua, finding few goods. There was an ample supply of rum and hot sauce, but little else in their pathetic shelves. When we went to restaurants, we ceased trying to order from the menu. Instead, we asked, "What do you have today?" We were there a scant 2 weeks, but on our return, we shopped to find ourselves in the position of that Russian refugee in the movie. And we've never recovered completely. We go to the superstore and see the overladen shelves of superfluous junk foods and shake our heads. There stand 50 brands of sugar-laden breakfast cereals, all the product of two or three corporations. 50 brands of coffee, again the indistinguishable output of a few monster companies. Who the hell are we sitting complacently in Canada to have this affluence while others starve? Is our apparent wealth the product of some moral superiority? Is it luck? Or might it be that we moved into a rich, relatively empty land, stealing it Israeli style from its original occupants? While inhabitants of other lands suffer under unscrupulous, violent dictatorships, yearning for a chance, like those Nicaraguans, to control their own destinies, we wallow in our superficial wealth. We, who inhabit McMansions, drive monster vehicles, and live on credit while performing often silly jobs, are unlike those scrabbling in barren plots to feed their families. And what do we do with our wealth and leisure? We're avid shoppers and consumers of rubbish who can hardly be bothered to vote and never involve ourselves in the politics of shaping our nation. They're all crooks, we say, eschewing any participation in our own governance. Our politicians have the lowest of popularity ratings even as they govern us. Who would want to get involved in the political melee except those whose ambition is not directed at the public good, but improving the lot of themselves, their supporters, and their particular ideology? We're victims of our own illusory success, and that will be our undoing. Malalai Joya, a female activist member of the Afghan parliament, has written a book entitled Raising My Voice, in which she speaks about out on the troubles of her country. She calls the oppression of women and Afghans' reluctance to make compromises tragedies hampering a peaceful future for their land. A review of this book in The Guardian contains some startling revelations. It says, her anger is directed against the Islamist fundamentalists and warlords who took power in 1992, ousted by the Taliban in 1996, but brought back by the U.S. in 2001. They still play a major role. The author says that socialists ran the country for 3 years after the Russians were ousted, but the Western-backed Mujahideen sabotaged this government. The unavoidable conclusion is that this 8-year war is the direct result of Western meddling and support for the very fundamentalist nutcases who are now an intractable enemy. She opposes the NATO occupation and says, the longer foreign troops stay in Afghanistan doing what they're doing today, the worse the eventual civil war will be. Meanwhile, the commander of all Western troops in Afghanistan, Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal, claims that the war there is still winnable. He stated, quote, the situation in Afghanistan is serious, but success is achievable and demands a revised implementation strategy, commitment and resolve, and increased unity of effort, close quote. Much hot air there, but what does he mean? He wants more resources, money, men and munitions, of course. Those resources would be applied to a whole new strategy. This new strategy would involve ceasing to chase and kill locals, but, you guessed it, winning their hearts and minds. He admitted that 8 years of slaughter and destruction have fueled rather than tamed opposition. Only 1 in 4 polled Americans are in favor of sending more soldiers to the Afghan front, but who listens to citizens when there's a war to be fought and profits to be made? What the hell is quantitative easing? We hear of it every day as a supposed remedy for the recession. The Guardian Weekly asked that question and received a couple of interesting definitions from readers. A man from the UK replied, quantitative easing is a crude laxative prescribed by financial practitioners as a quick remedy for the chronic economic constipation caused by reckless banking appetites. A reader in Quebec wrote that it is, quote, a term applied by journalists afraid of using the old-fashioned definition of printing money, which will make them appear either quaint or Luddite, while a more modern description is like a creative fiction where one branch of government buys debt issued by another branch of government while pretending that the taxpayer will never have to pay the piper, is unlikely to pass muster with their word-conscious editors. There you go. I like the idea of quantitative easing as a fiscal laxative myself. This concludes the 326th edition of my Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia.